live, or text KABU to 44321. Stay tuned now for KABU News in Depth.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Kanani Cortez, digital producer from Street Roots, to talk about her newest story. It's called New Year to Volunteer. Volunteering and community services are perennial New Year's resolutions. Here's how you can sustain your 2025 motivation throughout the year. Welcome to the show, Kanani.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on to talk with us. So your story this week is all about volunteering around town and some things to consider before getting started. You talk to folks who run organizations that rely on volunteers for this. So to start out here, why do people volunteer?
One of the things that motivates people to make this resolution to volunteer in the new year is often just knowing that there are so many opportunities to engage with their community, or, you know, some people feel a want to give back or share their resources and their time. And so I think a lot of people are motivated by that, but there's also many times where it is a requirement of, you know, the students might have a volunteer hour requirement if they're in high school, or folks who are encouraged to volunteer in their workplace. Some workplaces have incentives for that. And so I would be remiss to not mention that, you know, volunteering isn't always just a selfless act. Oftentimes people also have something to gain from it, which is not necessarily a bad thing, right? I think some people are seeking community, or if you're in retirement and you're feeling isolated, there's opportunities to stay involved or work with people around issues that you care about. So I think there are so many different motivations for volunteering. But aside from requirements or technical things, there's also just this want to be involved with your community and put your energy and efforts toward things that you care about. And there's so many different things. You know, there's environmental issues, human rights and civil rights issues, people who are interested in caring for animals, or working with people who are living on the streets or homeless, domestic violence survivors, or working with folks who are seeking abortion access and things like that, truly just to name a few.
Well, one of the folks you spoke to for this piece was Scott Kerman at Blanchet House. What does that organization do, and where do volunteers fit in?
Blanchet House runs a really robust meal program here in Old Town. They serve 3 meals a day at their kitchen, and there's a really large role for volunteers there. Many of their meals are mostly volunteer run, so folks can volunteer to bus tables or serve food or work in the kitchen and help with prep of food. And so there's always an opportunity and need there because they are doing this every single day, 3 meals a day. And that also means that there's different kind of ways to squeeze it in. He talked about some folks who like to come and serve for breakfast because then they go to work after, or they're able to come for the dinner shift because they'll be on their way home from work or things like that. Blanchet House also has a clothing closet where folks can volunteer to go through donations and give out clothing or coats and things like that. And they also run a housing program for men who are in recovery. And so I don't exactly know the volunteer opportunities for that, but There are many ways to engage with them. I think most widely known is their meal program.
Well, and he talked about some of the things that people get out of the volunteer experience as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. Scott was mentioning that, like I said earlier, you know, people are coming from all different walks of life or motivations to volunteer, but he's also seen really wonderful communities sprout up from people who choose to volunteer, or people who start book clubs and, you know, not only get to know their fellow volunteers, but the people who are accessing the services there. Another important thing he mentioned is an opportunity for change perspective. You know, oftentimes, if you are wanting to volunteer or get involved, people are coming from all kinds of backgrounds. And so they might not have the same view about homelessness or the housing crisis that another volunteer might, or don't have firsthand experiences with people experiencing homelessness or mental health crises. And so he said he's always appreciative of the opportunity for people to have a broadened perspective about the impacts of homelessness and, yeah, what that looks like in Portland. And I think that it's a really wonderful way to get to know your neighbors, regardless of housing status, and to learn more about people as individuals.
You also spoke to Monica Beamer with Street Books. What is that organization all about?
Yeah, Street Books is such a wonderful organization. They are a bicycle-run mobile library, and so their mission is to provide books and literature to people who are living on the streets. And so they have several street librarians, is what they call them, who operate their libraries and will show up in different places where folks can have the opportunities to check out books and just chat with each other. We have a street books library here in our office at Street Roots. And so the street librarian will come by and bring new books, talk to folks about books that they want to see and things like that. Street Books librarians also carry life-saving supplies like blankets or warm winter weather gear and Narcan or other medicine. So they are offering a really wonderful service beyond just, you know, life-saving needs, but also books, which I think so many people enjoy. They offer a broad range of things too. So whatever strikes your fancy as a reader, Street Books probably will have it.
Well, Monica also had some rather sage advice for folks looking to volunteer. Could you tell us about those?
Yes, I think I learned so much from Monica, and she talked about knowing what you need as a volunteer and what your limitations are, and also just that, you know, for a lot of people, and Scott gave similar advice, which is that it might take a few tries, and it's trial and error to find the thing that you want to engage in your community, and maybe an organization doing one thing isn't the fit for you, and you realize later down the line, oh, I actually really want to help with cooking, or I want to help sorting clothes, or I want to help plant trees in my community. And so there are really so many different roles. And also another thing that we talked about is that it's not always just a front-facing thing, right? Like serving meals or giving out supplies, but so many organizations need help with different tasks that maybe are more administrative, right? Maybe you're really good at Excel, and or you're a photographer and can help out by doing documentation or photo or media for an organization that needs it. And so one thing is to really know that there's so many opportunities out there and think about what you need. And another thing that Monica mentioned is also, if you say you're going to do something, doing your best to follow through with it. I think that as volunteers, and it's, you know, you don't work there, so sometimes you might not feel the same level of commitment, but just that if you, you know, are able to volunteer for something and commit to it, that you show up and follow through. Obviously, things always come up, and if something happens, just being a good communicator, and that, you know, organizations or groups that rely on volunteers really cherish the work that they do, and volunteers are such an essential part of so many of the efforts of so many different groups. And so she, I think, had really wonderful advice about, one, committing to things, but also knowing what you need as a volunteer and advocating for yourself is always really important.
In this piece, you also devote a paragraph to the distinction between mutual aid and volunteering. Can you explain what the difference is there?
Yeah, I think this is also kind of goes in line with what I mentioned earlier, which is, you know, commitment and responsibilities and all these things. But mutual aid is seen more as a reciprocal effort in your community. And so mutual aid can look like a lot of different things. And sometimes we might not even know that that's what it's called or what it is, but I think it implies a reciprocity when you're engaging with your community. So one of the examples I talked about was the PDX Free Fridge, and that is a collective that formed to help people open up pantries and fridges on their property for anybody who might need access to food or a pantry, could walk down the street and just grab it. And so there are people who can set up their own free fridge or pantry, and PDX Free Fridge has a really wonderful guide on their website about community guidelines and how to safely and responsibly do so. But, you know, I think the difference is there's also no tax write-off for that, right? And there's not the same level of red tape you would see at a nonprofit organization, which is not to say one is better than the other, but they're different. And I think that for you as an individual, people who are looking to get more involved and volunteer, you can kind of think about those things for yourself, about what is the immediacy of the thing that I want to do or get involved with. And I think a lot of criticism in the past of, you know, nonprofit volunteering in crises is sometimes the inability to respond as swiftly as a mutual aid group might be able to do. And again, not to say one is better than the other, just that they're different. And I think that that's really important for people to know and how they choose to engage and share with their neighbors. But I think one thing that is really valuable about mutual aid, it has a very radical roots, I think, is really rooted in people's intention to take care of each other and sharing the resources that we have. And so I think there are a lot of great collectives and groups that have sprung up. Another one that I mentioned was the Sweaty Butt Crack Collective, which, despite their silly name, does some really great work. And what they do is collect funds during extreme weather events or during incidences of domestic violence where people are seeking safe temporary housing. They are able to collect funds to get people into a hotel or temporary shelter situations. And so those are just two great examples of what mutual aid looks like sometimes in our communities.
I wanted to also mention there is a column of local organizations that you offer as sort of a place to start for people to look into. Could you let our listeners know what made your list there?
Definitely. So a few of these I had asked on our Instagram what some folks are excited about volunteering in the new year or places that they like to volunteer. Some of those were Mill Creek Kitchen or DPave or Portland Street Medicine. So we've got a few different things here for those who are interested in volunteering for addressing environmental issues. There's Friends of Trees, an organization that does a lot of work to plant trees in the community. There's also Neighbors for Clean Air, which, as the name states, they're interested in combating air pollution, and they have many initiatives and a guide for advocacy around clean air that you can find on their website as well. As I mentioned, there's Blaine Shea House, where you can volunteer to help them serve their daily meals. Portland Street Medicine is another collective of medical professionals, volunteers, caseworkers, and people who are helping get healthcare resources to people on the streets or people who are experiencing homelessness that don't have the same level of healthcare access. So you can volunteer there. And then we also have the Community Cycling Center for those who are interested engaging in work around cycling and community building in that way. Community Cycling Center does a lot of different initiatives. They have a nonprofit bike shop that they run, and so there are opportunities to help them with dismantling bikes to sell for parts or to cleaning bikes that they would then sell in their shop. And then, as I mentioned, the Sweaty Butt Crack Collective and PDX Free Fridge are mutual aid groups. I think something I neglected to mention around PDX Free Fridge is that even if you don't host a fridge or pantry in your property or business, you can also just contribute to them. You could drop off food and things like that. They also provide a guide on how to responsibly and safely donate food or other resources to the fridges and pantries, like making sure you're not donating expired food or listing allergens and the ingredients in food is really important. And then DPAVE, which is an organization that's interested in regreening certain areas. So they will have initiatives where they're essentially removing concrete and pavement to create more sustainable green spaces. And then lastly, we have Milk Crate Kitchen. They provide meals and deliver them as well for anyone who needs them. And on their website, they talked about being pretty low barrier in terms of volunteering. You just show up when you can, and that it can fluctuate. And so if you're interested in helping with delivering meals or preparing meals, Milk Crate Kitchen is a great place to do that. And I would be remiss not to mention Street Roots, the organization at which I work. Outside of just the newspaper, we have our vendor team and other programs that are always interested in volunteers. They do such essential work. And so if you're interested, you can always email us at volunteers@streetroots.org.
Awesome. Well, I guess this question would be then from your experience, or but also from the experience of writing this article. When you talk to folks who work with volunteers a lot, do they encounter misconceptions that people might have about volunteering?
Yes, definitely. I think that one of the things that was mentioned is that people often think that there's only one kind of volunteering. And the image they use is like, oh, I can serve food at a soup kitchen on Thanksgiving or things like that. But there are so many different skills and resources needed, and that also it can be hard. Many organizations might only have one person who's helping recruit volunteers or orient them into the organization. And so it might feel like a blow, but it's okay to be persistent and to keep reaching out and giving people your information. And so I think another big thing is that I was able to talk with Scott at Blanchet House is just this opportunity to engage and gain perspective about an issue that you might think you know about, right? Like, I know everything about homelessness and what it's like and why it happens, or I know what, you know, environmental issues we're facing in Oregon. And, you know, even if you're informed or feel really informed, that just getting with an organization, meeting a new group of people or a mutual aid collective, there are opportunities to just learn more and be in community with new people. I hope that people feel motivated to engage with organizations or mutual aid groups in their community, and also know that if it's on your New Year's resolutions or goal, the need is year-round, and there are so many ways to be engaged in the community in whatever way, shape, or form that you choose. And these are just a small few number of groups and organizations. And so I really encourage people to, you know, see what else is out there and, you know, reach out to an organization that they admire their work or interested in. And it never hurts to just send an email or make a phone call, especially for those doing work that you're passionate about.
If our listeners are interested in learning more, where can they find this story for themselves?
You can always buy a copy of Street Roots from a vendor. And I will always encourage that. It's a wonderful opportunity to meet our vendors. And you can also read our stories on streetroots.org.
Well, Kanani, I want to thank you so much for being on with us today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much. It was great chatting with you.
That was Kanani Cortez, digital producer at Street Roots, talking with me about her newest story. It's called New Year to Volunteer. Volunteering and community services are perennial New Year's resolutions. Here's how you can sustain your 2025 motivation throughout the year. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. The LA County wildfires burning now may be the costliest wildfire in U.S. history, according to CNN. Having severe wildfire in the winter in California is also quite rare. As this crisis unfolds, many are asking how such an affluent area like the Pacific Palisades could be so unprepared. There's a lot of factors at play, but certainly fire management has strayed far from how indigenous communities use fire to help manage the landscape, making for less catastrophic wildfires. One of these strategies is prescribed burns. We heard from an expert to learn more.
My name is Lania Quinn Davidson, and I am the director of the Fire Network for the University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources. So I basically run the Fire Extension Program for the University of California. And we have a team all around the state who works on various topics related to fire science and resiliency, including things like prescribed fire and wildland fire, home hardening, and kind of community resilience, and a whole host of other topics related to fire. So I direct and manage that team. And then I also specifically have a real passion and interest around the use of fire. So prescribed fire and cultural burning, doing policy work and training and capacity building. That's really where I focus in on my program.
What is prescribed fire?
Prescribed fire is an incredibly versatile tool, and it's basically the use of fire on purpose under really specific conditions to meet objectives that you've identified ahead of time. So those objectives are really wide-ranging and could include things like cultural objectives. So we have a lot of indigenous partners who use fire for things like basket weaving materials or for improving acorn crops or for hunting. But people also use prescribed fire for fuels reduction. So actually, you know, decreasing the risk of future wildfire and for invasive species control, for habitat restoration, for oak woodland restoration. There are so many different uses for beneficial fire.
How does prescribed fire affect the risk of future wildfires?
Prescribed fire is used throughout the United States to act as a tool for fuels reduction and to decrease the risks and of losses from future wildfires. I do want to make it clear that when we use prescribed fire, we're not necessarily trying to prevent future fire. We're really trying to prevent catastrophic consequences from future wildfire. So prescribed fire decreases the density of our forest, so makes things more open and more kind of clean and more, you know, you can look through a forest and actually see through it. That really helps with drought resilience. And then when a future fire comes in, it can burn through and not kill all the overstory trees. So we're really trying to moderate future fire severity.
How has the use of prescribed fire evolved in North American history?
Fire's kind of evolved, and the relationship between people and fire has evolved from really historically being one of the most powerful and primary tools that people use to shape their landscape for food resources, for travel, you know, just for overall habitat quality. And we kind of lost that connection. You know, in the 1900s, fire was outlawed. The use of fire became illegal in many parts of the country. And it's only in more recent decades that we're really trying to bring it back in and reclaim that connection with fire and start using it and understanding the power that it has.
How common are prescribed fires now, and where do they occur?
Because of the diversity of the users of prescribed fire, it can get a little messy trying to account for all of the burning that takes place. But we do have some pretty general numbers that we use. And I would say that the southeastern U.S. is really highlighted often for their incredible use of prescribed fire. So Florida, for example, is the top user in the country, tends to be, at around 2 million acres a year, which is really impressive and something that we should all be aspiring to. If you look at California, where I am, it's significantly less. The demand is just as high, but we're still kind of growing our capacity and our understanding of how to get these projects accomplished. We're lucky if we get around 100,000 acres a year treated with prescribed fire in California. And the state and the Forest Service have set some pretty ambitious goals for how to increase this use of prescribed fire and to grow the scope and scale of those projects. But there's really kind of a learning curve going on right now in the Western U.S. about how to do more of this. And we really do look to places like the Southeastern U.S., the Great Plains, to understand how they're doing so well with prescribed fire.
How safe are prescribed fires?
Prescribed fire is so thoughtful, and there's so much planning and consideration that goes into it, that we see a success rate of more than 99% of prescribed burns that go exactly, you know, how they have been planned. They meet objectives. They do not escape control. Less than 1% of the time, prescribed fires might go over the line, escape control, and require some extra help or resources to kind of bring things back under control. But very, very, very few prescribed burns ever cause any kind of damage to anyone's property. And so there are these different, you know, considerations that we think about when we think of the safety of prescribed fire and the liability behind prescribed fire. But really, the chances are that this work is going to go really well and really safely.
What role can prescribed fire play in ecosystems that are experiencing stress related to climate change?
There's been some really interesting research in the Western U.S. and in California specifically, looking at forest resilience in the face of things like drought and climate change and how prescribed fire can play a role in that. And what we find, especially for frequent fire-adapted dry forests, so forests like ponderosa pine and mixed conifer that we see in California and across much of the Western U.S., is that when they have intact fire regimes, when we've been able to restore fire as a process, which I always say, you know, fire is a process as important as rain or snow or sunlight in a lot of these forests. It's something that was so frequent. If we can restore that fire regime, then we see a great increase in resilience to things like climate change and drought and future wildfire. So it's really important that we restore this as a process. These are not one-time projects. Prescribed fire is not a one-off intervention. It's really a long-term commitment to the landscape that we recognize fire is important and that we're going to continue to bring fire into these places to make them more resilient.
What can you tell us about community-based prescribed fire projects?
We have about 24 community-based prescribed fire groups that are across the state of California that engage thousands and thousands of volunteers, and people are learning how to use prescribed fire. They're implementing their own projects, and they're doing it really safely. And so I liken it to a social movement. It really is. People are kind of reclaiming this connection, and it's fun and it's joyful and it's bringing people together.
How do state and local governments support or limit prescribed burns?
Prescribed fire policy is generally really at the state level. And so depending on which state you're in, you might have a whole different set of prescribed fire laws and regulations that govern the work that you do. Here in California, we have made a lot of progress in recent years on prescribed fire policy, really increasing opportunities for more people to be involved in this work and to have protections in this work. So we've changed the liability standard in California. We've created a state-backed insurance fund just for private prescribed fire practitioners and cultural practitioners. We've created a state burn boss program that kind of links to those liability protections. And we've really opened up so much more opportunity in this work. So it's really important because the state has so many goals and targets around prescribed fire, but there was a really limited group of people who could actually do that. And now we're breaking down those barriers. Other states are doing similar things. Places like Washington and Oregon are kind of following suit and doing similar work that we've been doing in California. And then a lot of states across the country already had good prescribed fire policies. I will say there's some work at the federal level that does need to be done. And there are people who are really focused on federal policy and how to kind of, you know, open up more doors and opportunities at that federal level, both for federal agencies, but also across state lines. So there's some interesting work happening there too.
That was Lena Quinn Davidson, the director of the Fire Network for the University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources, talking about prescribed fire as a strategy for managing wildfire risk. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information